Thanks for downloading our podcast. You can find out more about TechTent from our webpage. Go to bbcworldservice.com/techtent. Hello and welcome to TechTent, your weekly status update on the technology business. I'm Rory Catlin-Jones, and this week I'm joined by Fiona Graham and Mark Ward from the BBC Online Tech Desk. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hello.
Very good to have you. And my very special guest this week is Shivi Jervis, creator and host of the online innovation series Digital Futures. She was recently voted one of the top 100 digital leaders for Britain. Hooray. Shivi, welcome to
Thank
the show.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here and thanks for having me in one of your hot seats.
Now, here's a little taste of what's coming up.
Kathmandu seems to be getting back to normal from an infrastructure perspective. The operators have got the phones online and 3G's available most places throughout the valley. The challenge is understanding what's happening near the epicentre where a lot of the villages are cut off.
People have the right to measure what's going on inside their own body. I certainly demand the right to measure my own biology.
But first, just a few hours ago, one of the most audacious tech entrepreneurs of the age launched a whole new venture. Elon Musk, not content with creating the Tesla electric car and his own space program, now wants to revolutionise the energy market. He's bringing out a battery that could store enough energy to power a home. Our Richard Taylor joins us from Tesla's home state, California, to tell us more. Hi, Richard. What is this battery and how does it work?
Well, there were actually two batteries launched last night. One was called the Powerwall, aimed at homes, and another one, which is the Power Pack, aimed at businesses. And the idea is that it would harvest renewable energy, like solar, for example, and then when the sun isn't shining, it would then discharge that, for example, at night. And also for people who are on the grid, they would be able to pull off energy from the grid at the cheapest times of day, and then it would save them money because they would then have that energy discharged from the battery at what would otherwise be a very expensive time of day. But more than just the cost-saving aspect, there's this idea that it will provide an uninterrupted power supply. Believe me, even yesterday there was a power outage here. They do happen fairly frequently, not just, of course, here, but there are plenty of other parts of the world where Elon Musk said that this technology could be even more revolutionary.
This is going to be a great solution for people in remote parts of the world where there's no electricity wires, or where the electricity is extremely intermittent or extremely expensive. So you can take the Tesla Powerwall and it can scale globally. And in fact, I think what we'll see is something similar to what happened with the cell phones versus landlines, where the cell phones actually leapfrogged the landlines, and there wasn't a need to put landlines in a lot of countries or in remote locations. So people in a remote village or an island somewhere can take solar panels, combine it with the Tesla Powerwall, and never have to worry about having electricity lines.
That's Elon Musk punting his battery idea. Richard Taylor, what's been the reaction so far? Do people think it adds up?
A bit of a mixed reaction. The actual home battery is fairly expensive, $3,000 or $3,500 for the slightly bigger version. So that's a pretty hefty upfront cost for people to spend on a battery where they will only see the real cost savings over many years. And I think a lot of people are saying that actually the value proposition right now for homes is in making sure that, for example, when they're not there, there's an uninterrupted internet connection and their fridge keeps working. And that the real opportunities lie in the business sector, where you've got large-scale utilities, hospitals, universities, huge stores like Walmart, for example, that could really take advantage of this new battery technology. Because at the moment, there is a lot of expense obviously involved in powering these huge utilities. And if something like this could revolutionize that market, then it could be a real win. But there's a lot of competition too. There are lots of competitors. GE is working on this kind of technology as well. So it's by no means a sure win.
Thanks, Richard. And Mark Ward, you've been following this story, I know, today. This isn't actually brand new technology, is it?
No, it's very well established. I mean, Elon Musk is a visionary thinker, but with this, it's very well established. And I think that's part of what makes it interesting is that it's not the technology that they've lined up that's going to make a difference. It's all the other bits to get this installed and to start that kind of value chain so that it does work and it does roll out and it can maybe make a difference quite quickly.
Shivy Jervis, our special guest. Are you impressed by this? Are you excited by it?
Well, Rory, I am, because I focus a lot on the transformative power of tech to impact our daily lives and all the blogs and videos that I do. So the domestic battery, to me, is a great example of this because it could put some control back into the hands of us consumers, much in the way that smart meters have done in allowing us to track our energy usage, because it'll reduce our dependency on utility companies and grid power. My worry, though, is the price point.
Yes, that is the big question. Will people look at it and think they'll actually save more money than the $3,000 or so cost of buying this thing and getting it installed? We've got to move on. The devastating earthquake in Nepal last weekend did major damage to communications in the area. Why does that matter? Well, when coordinating rescue and recovery efforts, good networks are increasingly vital. So, all sorts of expert engineers, some from the charity Telecom Sans Frontières, have gone to Nepal to offer help. Among them is the mobile operator Vodafone, which has arrived with something called a network in a backpack. I called Justin Waller from Vodafone in Nepal's capital, Kathmandu, and started by asking him why communication was so important.
Communications is really key. It actually integrates the affected people, puts them back in touch with their community, with their loved ones. It actually makes them feel like things are coming back to normal. And not only that, it helps the coordination of the relief effort to understand what the impact is of the event at that location. So it sort of works on many levels, really.
And I know you've only been there a couple of days, but what are the characteristics of this disaster?
I'm in Kathmandu at the moment, and Kathmandu seems to be getting back to normal. From an infrastructure perspective, the operators have got the phones online and 3G's available most places throughout the valley. The challenge is understanding what's happening near the epicentre, where a lot of the villages are cut off. And you can get to major towns by road, but still the information is filtering back slowly as to what is needed there and what the exact situation is, because they're so isolated.
Now, what are you trying to achieve in particular? Let's start with this network in a backpack. What is that and what can it do?
It's basically a BTS tower in a small backpack. It weighs about 11 kilos. And what that is a small capacity base station that has an integrated satellite unit in it. It's got its own power supply, it's got a solar panel, etc. So you can run it off a car 12-volt battery. You could take that to a disaster zone once it's configured and have mobile GSM network. It's not a very high-capacity system. It's for use for just getting a GSM network where it might be needed urgently.
You've got something of a rather bigger scale too. Tell me about that.
Yeah, we have bigger style base stations that can carry many tens of calls consecutively that you might erect in a small town or a small area, cover a much wider radius. And other tools that we have sensor cells which might link back to another network. They're small cells like you may have at home linking over broadband back to the operator.
Is the technology here advancing fast? Is it possible now to get communications up and running in a disaster area more easily than it was, say, 5 years ago?
Yes, it's certainly easy to get communication, but there's still the logistic challenges just to get the equipment out there. Also, our reliance on emergency and communications and mobile communications in particular is a lot greater than it was. So it is easier, but the expectations got bigger as well.
That's Justin Waller of Vodafone in Kathmandu. Mark Ward, you're a bit of a boffin when it comes to how telecoms networks work. They are getting smaller and the equipment is getting easier to install, aren't they? I mean, we have made some progress, which should help in situations like this.
Well, that's true, yeah. I mean, certainly, you know, the size of the cells tends to shrink and, you know, get micro antenna or sort of femtocells and all kinds of things like that. But that, they tend to be clustered in places where there's a lot of use. And I think it's fair to say that Nepal has always been a challenging environment for any kind of mobile network, all those peaks and valleys and things like that. You're going to lose signal pretty quickly, and it wouldn't take much of a landslide to knock out one tower and then just you lose a whole region. But yeah, there's lots of smart ways to start networking these things. So data gets passed from phone to phone rather than back to the base station. There's mesh networking. There's a lot of work going into making those, you know, no matter how many devices you have, that data gets back. It's a best effort network, no doubt about it.
But those communications are pretty vital. Now, let's have a look at some of the week's other big stories. Fiona Graham, how did iPads ground some aircraft? That's your start of a 10.
It's an app called Flight Deck. and it crashed, basically. So American Airlines had to...
let's be clear, the tablet crashed.
Yes, not the planes.
Yes.
It wasn't the tablet itself, it was actually the app, which they were very, very keen to stress. So American Airlines has had to ground dozens and dozens of planes to cope with this. Apparently, all you actually needed to do was uninstall and reinstall, although a lot of pilots had to actually go away and print off the flight plans to be able to actually fly. Apparently, they stopped using paper in about 2013 because it weighs so much. It's about 16 kilos of paper per pilot. And, of course, weight means fuel. So they reckon that they're saving about $1.2 million a year by doing this. But, of course, there's always the cost of, you know, it goes down mid-flight and then what do you do then?
Yeah, it is kind of scary, the implications of our reliance on this technology when it goes wrong. Mark Ward, they're taking on online pirates in Russia.
They are. They started doing this in 2013 and aimed a law at video piracy in particular. Now it's been updated to cover software, songs and books. And it's pretty harsh. You know, the penalties, if your site is found guilty, you're cut off, you're banned forever.
And I don't want to be rude, but we don't necessarily associate Russia with being harsh on piracy. In fact, we have associated it with being one of the sort of centres of online piracy, haven't we?
You could say that, yes, indeed. But
I don't want to offend anybody there, but, you know.
Certainly not the Russians. But the I think they're trying to do something. But I think the problem is going to be that it's not clear how much difference it's going to make, because I'd imagine that most Russians are pretty good at working around the restrictions that officialdom would like to impose on their web browsing habits. And they'll do the same with this.
And Fiona, a controversial Silicon Valley startup, I'm told, has gone quiet.
That's right. This is Secret, the anonymous messaging app. It launched about 16 months ago. It had a valuation of about $100 million at one point. It was a talk of Silicon Valley. Millions of dollars of VC money going in from the likes of Ashton Kutcher. It basically allowed people to do exactly that, say things completely anonymously. So tech workers used it to share rumours about mergers, gossip about the tech regime. But it was also criticised for cyberbullying because, of course, you could say whatever you wanted.
Anonymity is a double-edged sword, as the founder admitted when he closed it down. Shivi Jervis, actually, this was not, in some people's eyes, a very nice company.
No, indeed not, because it thrives on gossip. So when Secret came out in early 2014, I decided, for editorial interest, to give it a bit of a test drive. And I was deeply intrigued by the sort of behavioural experiment aspect of it. What happens when we're nameless, faceless? How malicious, how dark, how open do we get?
I hope you weren't malicious.
Not at all. I don't think I had anything controversial to say. In fact, I was really worried about trying to find something spicy and I came up with nothing.
A salutary tale. It didn't appear to be a business model in spreading malicious rumours. Anyway, you're listening to Tech Tent on the BBC World Service with me, Rory Catlin-Jones. Still to come, the latest ideas in melding medicine with technology. Now, for investors in social networking firms, it's been a pretty scary week. Last night, the professional network LinkedIn committed the cardinal sin of disappointing the market about its growth prospects this year. Its shares are down nearly 20% today, last time I looked. Earlier in the week, Twitter also failed to match up to the market's expectations, and its shares are also down about a fifth on the week. Now, Twitter admitted that its advertising plans had failed to prove quite as attractive as it had hoped. And part of the problem is that it's competing with the industry giant Facebook. So we decided on a completely unscientific Tech Tent experiment.
So I'm going to buy two adverts. The first one is going to be a Facebook one. And I've chosen the audience, which countries it goes to. You can choose what interests that people should have. And I've put technology, radio, business. Choose an age range, and I've gone from 18 to 65, pretty wide, and no particular gender. Got my budget, $10 a day. I've set it only to run for a little while, and that's what the advert will say. Tech Dent, your weekly status update on tech with Rory Catlin-Jones on BBC World Service. And what we're hoping is that people will like our Facebook page. So let me press the button there. Promote page. We're reviewing your advert. Oh, they're going to make sure it meets their advert guidelines. It takes 15 minutes. So that's the Facebook one. That should be going live any minute. Now, the Twitter one. What do I want it to do? Again, the aim here is to increase the followers. So the BBC Tech Tent Twitter account. It's got a tweet which says, follow the BBC World Service programme that gives you a weekly status update on the tech business and find out if Twitter ads worked. I found it very difficult to actually put in a lot of countries. So, for instance, I tried to put in India as one of my targets, and it came up with Indiana. And the only African country I could get in was South Africa. Budget, again, £10 a day in this case, which over the period that it's running, I think is going to be roughly the same as the Facebook campaign. Save campaign. Let's see what happens. My campaign has been created successfully. Fabulous. Now let's find out if the ads actually encourage anybody to follow our Twitter account or like our Facebook page.
Now, that was 24 hours ago, and it must be said that the Facebook ads look to have been more successful. They've boosted the likes on our Facebook page. You can go and like it yourself, why don't you? Yourself, why don't you? They boosted them by about 300, while our promoted tweet, on which we spent more money, not a lot of money, but a bit more, that's only brought us around 70 new followers. Shivi Jervis, you're much more of an expert on this than I am. You've been buying online ads quite substantially for to promote your YouTube channel, is that right?
Indeed. So when we were trying to build Critical Mass right at the beginning, both for the Innovation Hub that I curate and Digital Futures, a video series, we put a fair bit of spend initially behind Twitter's platforms and Facebook. Now, while Facebook has been wiping the floor with Twitter in terms of monetization and the advertising models they offer, not to mention they trump Twitter's user base with 1.3 billion to Twitter's 270 plus million. In my experience, if you want great scale and critical mass super quickly, go for Facebook. But if you want good quality of engagement, then honestly, the industry influencers, the thought leaders, the media stars, the rock stars, the tech stars are on Twitter. You also have to ask, Rory, which social network does a better job on mobile? You know, 86% of the time spent on Twitter comes from mobile compared to 68%
for Facebook. Yeah, but look at Facebook's revenue. They were worried about their mobile revenue when they floated, and now 75% of their revenue, and many, many times what Twitter earns, comes from mobile. So, you know, Facebook is winning this, isn't it?
Facebook is hands down winning this. As I said, they absolutely are wiping the floor with Twitter. I think there is somehow, though, a role for Twitter in this, and that is that they are mining influencers.
Fiona Graham, how do you see this? Is Twitter ever going to be able to compete with Facebook in terms of getting advertisers to see them as a better place to spend their money?
I think it's very difficult. I mean, Facebook has all your data, and this allows them to target ads a lot more successfully, and it's in a less intrusive way. I mean, I know a lot of Facebook users might not agree with that. Whereas with Twitter, it's very easy for these ads to get lost in the newsfeed, scrolling through, and people don't see them. And when they do, they tend to get quite upset at seeing sort of promoted stuff and what they see is their data.
I think generally people just do not like adverts. They like to get stuff for free, but I get loads of complaints about adverts in social networks. People don't seem to realise that they've got to pay for them somehow. We've got to move on. Remember when collecting medical data was something only doctors and scientists could do? Now, as health and medicine become a boom area for technology investment, that kind of data gathering is open to just about anyone. That was just one of the themes at a major event about tech and health in London. The BBC's health editor, Hugh Pym, went along for us.
I'm here at the Wired Health Conference, and it's pretty busy. It's the second such event which has been held by Wired, and they're saying demand for places has been very high. And that's largely because of the coming together of medicine and technology, the growth in personalised medicine and devices to help individuals monitor their health and well-being. I've just met Clive Brown of Oxford Nanopore Technologies, and he's holding a small device, smaller than a mobile phone, which somehow can sequence a human's genome.
So the point of this is it's now pretty much on the market, albeit restricted access to experts, but that will change. And it's a USB stick, and it's a fully functional, full-on DNA sequencer. At the moment, if you wanted to sequence DNA, you'd have to go into a laboratory, and there'd be a very large machine there that costs hundreds of thousands of pounds, and it would be quite tricky for an ordinary person to do that. We empower ordinary people to measure their own biology and understand their own biology at home.
Aren't there pretty big ethical issues about an individual and this sort of data about themselves?
But I think people have the right to measure what's going on inside their own body, and the right to figure out what it means. I mean, you could make the same argument about the internet. Everybody now Googles their symptoms and go to their doctor with a pre-idea of what they've got.
There are some people who would have banned that for ethical reasons. I think this is a new frontier, and I certainly demand a right to measure my own biology.
Making health monitoring devices more attractive to consumers is a real theme in the medical tech industry. Just look at the growth of wearable tech that measures your heart rate and other vital signs. Gadi Amit is the designer behind products, including the Fitbit range of wearables.
If people are to be walking around enjoying life, they need to be even encouraged or feel proud of these pieces of technology, and design is central to that. I think for the longest time, design within the medical sphere was seen either utilitarian or actually serving the medical professionals. We now need to think a lot more about the people who are carrying these devices, people who need to be feeling very comfortable and very natural with these devices, and design is central to do that.
One area benefiting from better design is prosthetic limbs. I caught up with Nigel Ackland, an amputee, testing out the latest in bionic arms.
It's very, very basic. I have an electrode that sits against my skin on the outer edge of my forearm, another one that sits against the skin on the inner edge of my forearm. If I contract the muscle on the inner edge, which is basically like squeezing a ball, the electrode is activated, it sends a signal to the hand, and the hand will then close.
Were you the first person globally, anywhere in the world, to test this out?
I think I was, yeah, and I've been using it every day ever since, really.
But technology has just opened up a new world, has it?
Yeah, and it's changing people's attitudes now. I mean, pink plastic just doesn't cut it anymore. It will become a fashionable thing. Exosuits for able-bodied people to go posing on the dance floor, they will become a reality. But off the back of that, people in wheelchairs are going to get the chance to stand up. Now, people like me are going to get a chance to shake hands.
That report from our new young reporter, Hugh Pym. Shivi Jervis, I know you're excited about medical technology. What in particular excites you?
I am. This is really riveting stuff for me because I write about it quite a lot. What I'm really interested in is the next wave of health-related wearables called the ingestibles.
So not outside your body, but inside your body.
No, you swallow this stuff. So, you know, you've got one square millimetre of a sensor in the form of a safe-to-swallow tablet. Let's call it a digital pill. And how this works is the sensor is activated by the natural electrolytes in your system. The pill then sends a signal to a battery-powered patch on your body. That then sends us data to your phone or even that of your family or your carer, which is really handy. You know, Rory, 50% of us fail to take our meds correctly. And what this will do is alert us if we're taking the wrong dose of medications, mixing two that aren't compatible, or even forgetting to take important medication.
Fiona Graham, there's a lot of Silicon Valley excitement about this, but this is very different from investing in a, you know, smart new social network, isn't it?
It is. I mean, you can't fail fast with healthcare technology. And if your app or your product is designated as a medical device as opposed to a leisure device, you've got an immense amount of regulatory framework that you have to go through, clinical trials, all the rest of it. It can be 10 years to market. But then that said, there's huge amounts of money to be made. I mean, if you look at Elizabeth Holmes, who started up Theranos, it's about blood testing on the cheap. She's the world's youngest female billionaire.
There's a thought. There's a lot of money in health tech if you spot the right thing. We're running out of time again, I'm afraid. Thanks to my special guest, Shivi Jervis, host of the online series Digital Futures, and to Fiona Graham and Mark Ward from the BBC Online Tech Desk. Thanks to you for listening. Keep in touch via our Twitter feed at BBC Tech Tent. Please join me again next time.